The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey, Paco, would you spend $300 and wait 8 months to eat sushi?
No.
What if it was the world's best sushi?
If you're buying. Hi, I'm Paco Romaine.
Hey, I'm George Chen.
Welcome to SupDoc, a show where we talk to musicians, comedians, and filmmakers about their favorite documentaries.
Today, we're going to be talking about the 2011 documentary Jiro Dreams of Sushi, directed by David Gelb. It's a story of Jiro Ono, an octogenarian sushi master and owner of Tsukiyabashi Jiro in Tokyo.
And our guest today is comedian Riley Silverman. Riley, why did you pick?
I picked Jiro Dreams of Sushi because I felt like it was, I call it the best movie about comedy that's not actually about comedy.
Ooh, snap.
It's like that and like The Wrestler, the movies in the last like four or five years.
The Wrestler also reminds me, there's that scene in The Wrestler where they're at the indie wrestling convention.
Yeah.
And we talked about this a little bit when we did a episode about The Sheik, the Iron Sheik documentary. I don't know if you've seen that one.
I haven't, but I've heard of it.
It's worth checking out. Two.
Yeah. I'm not even a big wrestling guy, but like I was like, this reminds me of like the noise scene. Like when I was in noise music, like it's just like a guy's like, do you want to buy this VHS? I'll sign it for you.
I went to one of those conventions one time when I was on the road doing, I was in Cleveland, and it was me and John Heffron and Louis Katz, and we just thought we were killing an afternoon, and we went into one of the conventions. The Iron Sheik was there.
Wow.
And it was like at the height of him having like really bad drug problems and stuff like that, so he was and his health was really bad.
Ugh.
So he was actually like dozing off at his booth a lot, and would basically like they actually had a washcloth or towel around his neck, so when he goes off, he would like drool, and it would, like catch the. It was like the saddest thing in the world.
So just like Louis Katz.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. That's incredible. I forgot
Louis from here. That's right. That's funny.
Yeah. I want to know though, like, how do you draw that parallel between this documentary and comedy? What's your thinking there?
Well, I think first of all, I think it's just the idea of like art in general. Like he views doing sushi, like making sushi and cooking, the way that we like should ideally kind of view art, although like it does consume his whole life. And I think that comics for the most part do, once you've been bit by that bug, it really does become everything about you and it becomes like your main obsession. And I've seen so many people who their lives almost like get destroyed but also built by it somehow. Like it's just like it's like how much the confession, the like obsession affects your life.
What is the comic equivalent of just washing rice then? Is it doing an open mic?
I think doing open mic, especially we were talking off mic about how
it's really white.
Well, like, or it's, yeah,
and
it's
sticky.
Very white. Yeah, it's like the thing we were talking about earlier about people going to mics, just grueling it out and doing the same stuff over and over again. It's like that guy in the movie who is making eggs every single day for like months and months, just making eggs. And then every day, like they like throw his eggs away. Your eggs are terrible. Get better at your eggs. Like that's what
some people are just going to have E. coli in their eggs as comedians.
Exactly.
That's what it's going to be like.
So it's one of those things where it's like the idea of seeing this person who's just obsessed with it. And then the idea of like, I mean, most comedians don't have their kids in their shadow, but there's like other comics, like maybe like protege comics that come up beneath them. So all the stuff about like the sons and like them trying to be like him. And there's a whole thing in the documentary about how his oldest son might actually be better at it than he is, but they don't like quite touch. Like they do say that he's the one that was cooking the day the Michelin star guy came in.
Yeah.
And that's like a really deep in the documentary revelation, but it's like a really big thing about like, because there's a lot of times I think with comedy shows where you'll see people who come in. I was talking with a friend recently about how big name comics will do like local showcase shows and kind of phone it in, and you kind of get annoyed by it. Like, hey, you know, I get that this doesn't matter to you like it does other people, but the audience came to see a show. And like, there's a lot of times I feel like it's even better sometimes to book like middle road comics who are going to be really happy for the stage time and are going to work hard. And then I think if you do that a lot, you'll start building a better show and let the people who are kind of like better than that room just do the bigger rooms that they're going to be paid for anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an interesting, I get the draw of bringing in a big name comic to draw audience members in. But I feel like if you just book really funny comics and have good shows every time, I've seen examples where it's like really worked for the show over time to have.
So like basically like the person that is already, they have nothing to gain Mm-hmm. They have very little to lose and nothing to really gain by doing well.
Yeah.
But also when you're like doing a free show, you're in LA, so it's like the free Tuesday night show at like Bar Lubitsch.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be like, oh, Pete Holmes is here.
Yeah.
And he treats it as pure fucking around time.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is great for him.
Sure.
And people enjoy it.
It can
when
be
it's
good.
Him.
Yeah.
But I also see that point of like people come in and then someone like me who's mm-hmm. visiting from out of town, like, I got to kill at this free show.
Yeah, yeah.
Versus someone who's like, oh, this is my mic.
Yeah.
Right, right, right.
In this
right.
documentary, I feel like the people who go and he's cooking are already going to feel better about the meal because he's the one cooking.
Right.
Whereas it, like his son may actually be a better chef than he is, but they will always put him... Like the whole thing was like, is he ever going to be like out of his father's shadow? And it's like, he kind of is, but you just don't see it.
Well, there's that guy that says he's going to have to be twice as good as his dad to mm-hmm. be just as good as his dad once he takes over for his dad. I said the word dad a lot in that sentence.
Yeah,
but
well, like, it was in context.
That's appropriate. I mean, I feel like there is like a big like father, you know, son drama to this.
Sure.
If there is a drama, that is a drama to
yeah.
it. I mean, it's about like almost like just perfectionism is part of the drama.
Right.
And the other part of the drama is there's two sons, one who basically stays at the original restaurant, which is Tsukiyabashi. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but in Tokyo.
You're probably better, closer than any of us.
Yeah. And then there's a younger son, Takashi, and this is interesting. So some critics, even Obama, says it's the best sushi he's ever had. And Obama's like, I grew up in Hawaii.
Yeah. That's a good pull quote for a menu.
Yeah.
You know?
Leader of the free world. But then the son, so one son's opened another version of the restaurant that's basically a mirror image version of the restaurant.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think he's right-handed, his dad's left-handed, so the restaurant's facing the other direction so he can work better. It's kind of a weird but cool thing about it.
Yeah, no, that's really... And he mentioned not having his feet in the same direction.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah, there's something about that. It's been... I haven't seen it as recently as you guys, but there is something to that. Like it's like his defiance is facing the other direction or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I want to know a little bit more about you and where you grew up. When did you start doing comedy? A little bit more about your comedy.
I started comedy in 2001 in Ohio, in Columbus, Ohio. So my home club is the Columbus Funny Bone. Mm. And I did comedy there I was there until 2005 or 6, and then I moved out to LA for like a month, and I just didn't have a good plan. So then I went back to Ohio, tail between my legs, and I was in Ohio for a couple more years. I tried the same thing again with New York, and that one just, I had a series of unfortunate like things fell apart, so I couldn't stay in New York either. So I moved back to Ohio for about another year or two, and then in 2010, I moved out to LA, and I've been there since then.
Gotcha.
So that time it stuck.
And you do road work and
I don't do as much as I used to. I did a lot more road work before I moved to LA, and part of moving to LA was that I had come out as transgender about a year before I moved out here. So this coast and
2009 ish.
Yeah, I came out in the fall of 2009, mm-hmm. and then I moved to LA in April 2010. Mm-hmm. So and part of the idea was like I was doing road work, but it was all very like lower rung road work. It was a lot of one nighters and a lot of like bar gigs, and it was all stuff that was a little bit brutal and a little bit it was tough to really have your own voice with a lot of those gigs because they really wanted to hear very specific types of material, and it wasn't what I was good at and what I liked doing. And I was just getting and I could hardly make any money doing it. Like I was doing okay. I got to a point where I was making most of my income doing comedy and then substitute teaching on the side. Mm-hmm. But I just was like, this is not the career that I want to have. And I remember I had this really brutal, and I wanted to come out, but I was afraid to.
As a comic in the Midwest.
Right. And like, I was like, all this work that I do is not going to last. Like, I'm not going to mm-hmm. be able to go do bar gigs in like upstate Michigan, like by mm-hmm. by the UP and dress the way that I do and present how I do. So
maybe.
Yeah. I mean, some of them, maybe some of them not, but I mean, there were some that were better than others, but there's some where I definitely know I couldn't have done it.
I think the city of Escanaba would welcome you with open arms.
Yeah, maybe. I did Escanaba. I did the Chippin's Island Casino.
Yes.
Yeah, I did it for Entertainment Max.
Nice. Well, also part of the idea is when you're in LA is you want to stay around and just get whatever opportunities are going to emerge from there.
Yeah.
So doing road work actually becomes, I've heard this a lot with people that
detrimental.
Move there. Yeah. It's like actually not good to be on the road a lot if your point is to be closer to the industry.
Yeah, I would like to be able to go on the road more than I do, but that's because I haven't done it in 5 years. So I do like random things like this weekend up here. Like I went to Seattle back on like Memorial Day weekend. So it's like I'll get a couple of spots here and there. I would like to be able to go like take a month and do a bunch of shows and come back to LA, which a lot of people do. But it's so hard to do that and like keep your head above water.
But you said you started in 2001, so you've been doing this a long time.
Yeah,
yeah. So you have all that experience. Yeah.
I know that I would. I'm happy with my act right now, but I would like to have that polish of being on the road a lot again because I feel like you write a lot when you're doing long sets every night in different places. Mm-hmm. It just makes you write.
Yeah.
It's like it's like making eggs every single day for a long
time. Right. Yeah. You throw away 400 jokes until you get the one that sticks. And,
yeah.
And yeah. Absolutely.
And you went to? Did you go to college in Columbus?
Yeah, I went to Ohio State University and I got an English degree. Mm-hmm. And I didn't play for the team.
Okay.
And you were.
I liked the team. I root for them. But
were you doing stand up in college or no?
Yeah, I started in the middle of my freshman year. And I kind of basically stayed in college because as long as I was in college, my parents let me stay for free at their house and I would commute to school and then I could do comedy. Like I only had to have like a very basic part time job to pay my own bills and then like pay my cell phone bill and stuff like that. But I could stay at home rent free and it made me able to, like in the summer when I wasn't in school, go do weeks up in Cleveland or Cincinnati and stuff like that and do these crappy road gigs.
Is the Funny Bone, is that a Yoder Funny Business?
No, that one is not. That's a Dave Stroop. Dave Stroop is the Funny Bone in Columbus and a lot of the ones around there.
But Columbus is like still like a college town. It's like one of the cooler cities in Ohio, right?
Yeah,
it's basically major, Cleveland.
It's no Toledo,
Columbus.
But
no Akron. I don't know.
No Akron.
That's pretty much all. Yeah, Dayton's the last one we have mentioned.
Cincinnati's cool.
Yeah. Well, you said Cincinnati and Cleveland. Oh, you said Toledo, Dayton, and then there's Columbus.
That's all there is.
Yeah.
Then there's Youngstown.
Yeah.
You love sushi?
I do love sushi. I hear that from my father. My dad's a big sushi. My dad's actually a sashimi guy. Like, he will just... We would go to these, like, all-you-can-eat places that would, like, buffets that would also have, like, a sushi chef where, like, you would just tip them to make it worth their while. And make and at one point, they, like... I think one of them told my dad, like, it's like the John Panette joke of, like, you must go now. Dad would just... He just would go play. And he would tip. Like, he would treat the guy well, but he just would... The restaurant itself was like, we're not making any money off of you. You're eating all of our sashimi.
Like, in The Simpsons, it's more appetite than man.
Yeah,
when Homer goes to that all-you-can-eat fish. Yeah.
So you grew up eating a lot of raw fish in Ohio.
I didn't when I was a kid. The only thing I ate as a kid was like California rolls. Like that's what I called sushi. My dad would eat the raw fish. I didn't get into eating the raw fish sushi until like adulthood because that's when I was willing to give it a chance.
Yeah.
But now that I have, I really like it.
And then you moved to California.
Yeah.
So
all the proper things.
Paved the streets with sushi out here.
Yeah. I want to go to where sushi is a fast food restaurant. It's not bad.
Yeah. That is. I love sushi so much. I have a few favorite sushi restaurants in San Francisco. Live being my favorite one. If you guys ever get a chance. Place is astounding.
Our new sponsor, Live Sushi.
Yeah, let's hope, man. Let us hope. But so what is something from this documentary that you learned that you thought was really interesting about the making of or
I don't know. I don't think I felt like the documentary for me taught me a whole lot about the process of making sushi more than like what I vaguely understood more. For me it was much more fascinating just the intensity that Jiro puts into it, and like the level of like the way like he wouldn't take days off, and like when he's on vacation, he's like freaked out about it, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. Like that was just really impressive and interesting to me. And that's also just photograph, like just it's just a beautifully shot documentary. Like it makes you so hungry watching it. And, like,
yeah. Yeah, it does. It is beautifully shot. I was reading that the director, David Gelb, he wanted to make a documentary about various sushi restaurants in the world.
Yeah.
And went to that one, and he was like, hold up.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he's like, this is the place. Like, yeah, this crazy-ass dude. He's like 90 years old and still doing it in a subway station.
Yeah, I would love to go eat there. I'm sure by the time I get to Japan, he'll be dead. But I just like, and also... get to Japan and have $240 to drop on a tasting menu. It's like, there's a couple places in LA that do the same kind of thing where you can only order, like you can't order, you just get the chef's tasting menu. And even there, it's like $100 and something for that. And I'm like,
I feel like the title sort of explains a lot, because it's like this, basically his waking life and his subconscious are completely consumed by this process, which is, it's not just like, some Malcolm Gladwell, like 10,000 hours. Like, yeah. I mean, I don't know how many hours. At this point, the guy is 90. How many hours has he put into this?
Oh, my God, I can't imagine.
But it's also, it's not just about repetitive manual labor as much as it's all, like, they go sourcing all the fish. There's, like, just, there's so much that goes into just the presentation.
Yeah.
Like, basically feng shui, whatever the Japanese version of that is, you know, there's all sorts of stuff. But it's like, yeah, I almost feel like he's not a good father because of sushi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you feel that
he's
way?
He's like one of those characters, like in an AMC drama where it's like a Mad Men, like where he's like so obsessed with his job.
Yeah.
And he neglects his entire family constantly.
Or the only way his children will get his attention is by being so good at sushi.
Right. Yeah. Or even better.
He can love them.
Yeah. Well, it's that Shokunin word that they keep bringing up where you try to get perfection through your craft through just doing it over and over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't, like, who's the equivalent of that in comedy, do you think?
I would probably say somebody like Kyle Kinane is a good example of somebody who, like, he had just blown up when I moved out to LA. And he was talking about how he would just go to every single mic in LA and do every possible type of show.
Kinane.
Well done.
Derail your thought for a pun. For a pun.
That's fine.
But he would go and just keep just doing it.
Yeah, and he, and like, I remember reading a quote from him about, like, you have to go at every possible stage you can so you can see how your voice works. And I try to keep that to heart too. Like, we were talking off mic about people who only do one show and the same show, which is, I guess, that's the opposite point of view of making eggs every day.
That's what I wonder,
but,
yeah.
But I think it's still... maybe it's because, like, once you become a sushi chef, he's not just making, like, yellowtail belly every day. He's like I think his tasting menu is like 20 courses, right? So, like, he's learned all these things, and it's basically every day he's making works of art that are going to be consumed and destroyed, and then the next day he's going to get up and do the same thing and just like, make this work of art. And I think that's like guys like Kinane or guys like Louis C.K. who just, like, every year put out a new set of material, and like, or like Carlin, who would always just churn out a new hour. It's just like, you know, the pursuit of that perfect material is more important than the finished work you've already made.
Do you think you would have eaten Carlin's sushi in the last few years of Carlin's life?
Yes.
I would have
his comedy sushi. You would have eaten.
I would have tried it.
I think he kind of got better again towards the end.
Really?
Of
okay.
I think there was that point where he was doing a lot of the stuff that Talk Last makes fun of all the time, but I think that he kind of found his voice again towards the end.
Well, he had like 8 heart attacks.
Yeah.
Like, I saw him live, and it was one of the worst shows I've ever seen. It was right after one of his heart attacks. He was super white. Like, he was almost translucent, and there was very little energy, and he, like, stumbled a lot, and it was just kind of sad. But then he lived another 10 years after that, and I've heard the same.
I almost feel like the closer thing might be Gallagher and Gallagher 2, right? It's like a guy who's, like, perfected this one thing, then he's got another guy to, like, kind of, like, replace him, but then there's, like, some tension. Well, there's different tension.
There's
here.
A lot of
it's
tension.
Not just like if Gallagher's son came out, son of Gallagher, I guess it's almost there is other people that kind of
like Damon
do this
Wayans
act.
And Damon Wayans
Jr. Yeah.
Or I was gonna
actually,
say
that's not
Rain
a bad
Pryor.
Analogy because the Wayans, like, they've basically passed their film empire onto the sons now. Like, yeah, it's like the third generation of Wayanses.
They're
like,
smart, man.
Because, like, yeah.
Can you imagine getting hit with, like, a Sledge-O-Matic sushi? Like, it would be so disgusting.
Oh, you'd never get that smell out of your sons. It'd be smashed somewhere important.
Women can't appreciate this sushi smash.
Like, that's kind of what would it be.
Yeah, we haven't talked about that yet.
Oh, this great quote that I think dates back to before the movie came out about why Jiro... Is it Jiro? Jiro.
I think it's Jiro.
Jiro Ono.
I'm kind of saying it half and half, so I feel like I'm covering all my bases.
You know the Jiro. Latino sushi chef, Jiro Ono, he claimed that women, because they menstruate, cannot be professional sushi preparators because menstruation means your taste in food fluctuates. Huh. You can't have that steady...
Right.
Penis-based flavor.
He's like the Donald Trump of sushi making.
Yeah. Oh, my God. You're listening to Bernie Sanders' Dreams of Sushi, which is our new podcast, where we combine documentary films about Japanese food and current political talk.
We need the Pelosi daughter to make a third documentary so we can have...
We were talking about the 20-course meal, and one of the things I thought was... pretty interesting was that it's to be consumed in about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
30 minutes tops. And you're paying $300, which I...
370, according to this thing. Yeah.
It comes out to...
30,000 yen. Yeah.
Oh, man. It was like 240 when I last heard. Maybe the exchange rate has changed.
Yeah, it might have been exchange
it's
rate.
It's basically $10 a minute for your meal, which is incredible. And I love that. I love that... that moment when that kid comes in and he's like, so, oh, what about appetizers and sake? And they're like, nope.
Yeah.
You're not getting any of that, son.
No just California sushi. Roll.
Yeah. Yeah. Just sushi.
10 seats only. I forgot about that part. There's only the room at the bar.
You
That's
have to
all
reserve.
There is.
Yeah. You can't even just like, you can't walk in and get lunch. Like you have to reserve like months ahead of time. And it's like that kind of thing.
That's crazy. I would eat there. I would love to eat
there. Yeah.
I would love to just try. I got $300 I can drop for some sushi.
I'd be willing to put that on my credit card, I think. Yeah. I'd be willing to pay that off over a few months.
Hopefully they take credit cards.
Because like, that's a story that you would never... Yeah.
Let's just go do stand-up comedy in Japan.
Let's do it.
It can't be hard at all, the book.
No. It'll be the Shokunin tour with Kyle Kinunen. Your host.
Going back to the women can't cook sushi thing, I think that's actually a fun analogy to stand-up comedy, too. Yeah. We always hear that conversation coming up.
Nice.
Which is funny.
That is funny. Yeah, it's also a taste thing, I suppose. So they show the apprentices. What do you think about the 10-year apprenticeship that you have to endure?
That's actually really amazing to me, the idea. Because like, it's one of those things where you spend 10 years working for him, and then you probably are set for life as far as having your own business is concerned. Because once you've been able to say you studied under this master, like I was told, that's kind of how Berkeley works. Like a lot of the restaurants there, like
right because of what's her name, Alice Waters.
Yeah,
like everyone who's worked at Chez Panisse,
Chez
famous
Panisse, right.
restaurant in Berkeley. There's a ton of restaurants in the whole East Bay that are like proteges of Chez Panisse.
Yeah,
you've got that credential at that point. That's a good point. Yeah,
yeah. So it's almost like going to like med school. Like it's one of those things where like you want to have a career in this business.
Yeah.
So you train under the best person in that business, and then you have a long apprenticeship.
Is med school like
it's
that?
Longer than med school.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm just saying like it's like going. You're getting the best education you can. So like, yeah, I would say it'd be like going to like Harvard Med School, where it's like you're going to the biggest school and you're almost guaranteed to have a job in the industry once you get like as a doctor. If you went to Harvard Med, you're probably going to get a job somewhere.
Well, it reminds me more of maybe like in classical music, there's this idea, and this maybe is like because it's a longer skill, really specific skill over a long period of time, and where it still mattered, like I trained with this person who trained with this person, you can actually have this training lineage that goes back.
Yeah.
Which I think is a little bit different than a formal like schooling.
That's fair.
It's more of an apprentice. Yeah, the idea of an apprenticeship or a mentorship, which in this case specifically, there's his sons and there's also the people that are just like, well, now you're like the squid guy or something.
And they can actually do better than his sons do because they have the freedom to go off and do their own thing, whereas the sons are bound by that honor.
I love that, like, you got to, for like 3 years, you're just squeezing the towels.
Yeah.
Like, that's amazing to me. I don't know. Could you think that would work in America with like millennials and whatever the fuck who's coming after millennials? would squeeze a towel for 3 years.
You're gonna learn Serato to DJ like Steve Aoki after whose father ran Benihana. So that's another connection. But yeah, no, I don't think like I could even deal with like grad school. That'd be too much for me.
Right.
Yeah. Like 2 years of like one subject. Ugh.
Yeah. You know? This is 3 years of squeezing the towel.
Yeah.
I just love that. I thought that was hilarious. And then you go on to cutting the fish. Right. Mm-hmm. After you squeeze the towel, then they teach you how to hold the sushi like a baby chicken. Right. That was the other thing. You hold it like a baby chick, which is incredible as well. The entire movie just made me want to eat sushi.
It did.
Just
oh
watching
gosh.
The whole thing. And I do like what his oldest son was saying, who's
Yoshikazu.
Yeah. Yoshikazu was talking about how he was a kid, his family couldn't afford to eat sushi, even though his dad was a sushi maker.
Yeah.
And now there are conveyor belts of sushi conveyor belts.
It became so popular.
Yeah. I mean, and you can go to any local market and they all have like sushi already ready made. Yeah. And so they talk about the overfishing in the world and how the tuna population is dwindling.
Yeah. Which is a shame. That's the downside. Because I was thinking about that myself. Like I almost feel bad eating sushi as much as I do because I'm like, oh, the fish that they use are going to ruin the planet to do this.
Yeah. And then there was this horrible, after this documentary was made, I think it was 2011, the nuclear meltdown. That doesn't get addressed in there. So there's that that island, or it's not an island, the power plant that had the meltdown.
Yokoshima or Fukushima?
Yeah.
Fukushima.
I mean, I feel like that had to have affected the sea life.
Oh, I'm sure. And also
Japan.
Just all the mercury that's in the water. Yeah. Like all that sushi is like full of mercury. So it's like, I don't know why that word sounds weird that I'm saying it now, but it's
mercury.
Mercury. I don't know. Yeah. I was like mercury.
Meerkat. Meerkat carries.
You got to just say it more through your nose.
Yeah, the randomness of my Midwestern accent occasionally pops through, and that was one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes you wonder, like, what's in the water out there? But, like...
Do you think that's an analogy to comedy, that, like, we're overfishing the waters now? That's why you have, like, 35% open mics?
Talk about bottom feeders. Yeah.
Yeah, like, there's definitely conveyor belts of comedy going around. There's the food poisoning of comedy is the easiest. Yeah.
I feel like every art form that used to be kind of the niche art form in the last, like century now is all like how many bands are there out there? Like it's one of the things. How do you even begin to rise above in any of these things?
Yeah,
like
no,
painting and writing poetry and writing novels, all these like
making
TV
documentary
writers.
Films.
Yeah.
Yeah,
like how do you get through? How do you clutter through? There's so much clutter.
Although I feel like documentary films might be one of the few where there's actually more of a market than there used to be.
I agree.
Because of all the resources,
because of streaming,
and it's so hard. It's not like you wake up and you're like, I'm 22. I graduated from state college. I'm going to be a comedian.
Yeah,
you know, like that makes. Making a doc is so tough, but there is just a, I mean, let's just take a poll. How many comics do you think there are in the United States? People who call themselves a comedian.
Shit. Well,
100,000.
Think our state, our city is a pretty large, if you count the entire Bay Area. I was thinking about this the other day. I'm like, there's got to be maybe 1,000.
Okay.
If you count all of the surrounding Bay Area.
Yeah.
Like if you go down to Santa Cruz and if you go up to Sacramento.
It seems like a lot.
That's at least
And that's including people who like mic it up once a month. Or
More. Anyone who's done a mics occasionally, even people that have stopped, I'd think there'd be maybe 1,000.
At least.
I think if just Oakland, San Francisco, at least 600.
Right.
So I think if you include all the outlying areas.
And what's crazy about that is George and I are the best ones out of those thousands.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Top, we're the Shakunin. Shakukins.
We're the Shakukin it. We're Shakukin. We're just Shakukin it today.
And arguably not a Bay Area comic at this point.
Who knows?
We're California comics.
Yeah.
But no, there was so many. But yeah, it definitely is watered down. I don't think we have like a Jiro Ono. Around here. I mean,
maybe Will Durst.
Durst is like, like
Margot Gomez.
People that are like not Michelin rated, or maybe they are actually, but they don't flaunt it, or there's like they've built up a credibility.
Well, pre Robin death, it'd be Robin Williams.
Robin would have been
was our dude.
One.
Sure, yeah.
But I think Will Durst, I mean, he's been doing it since the early 80s at this point. He's Shokunin himself right up there. And he's still going strong. I would say Will and then Marga Gomez. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's a machine.
Yeah.
What would we consider the comedy equivalent of a Michelin star? Like, I feel like if it was 20 years ago, I'd say a Carson spot. But now, maybe more than 20 years ago at this point. But like at the heyday, that would be a thing. Maybe like
Netflix special.
Maybe Netflix special will be like maybe like a 1-star kind of thing, yeah. And like HBO special is a 2-star. Like
being on this podcast,
yeah. Hey, yes. I'm a 3-star.
That's like half a Michelin.
Or like, I was gonna say like before he retired last year, a Letterman spot right. Might have been like one of those big star ones.
Well, that's true. Yeah, when Carson would call you over, that would be like
that's
a
like 3-star.
Yeah, yeah, that's like getting some Michelin stars.
And that kind of that's like being The Apprentice, because that's like when that happened to you, that major career, that was like you're done. You're in at that point.
Yeah.
Like you're a Seinfeld. You're a whatever.
And you can't have unless you you're not gonna have like your son do your act. You know, that's not a thing that's typically going to happen.
No, I can only think of like one father who, one like famous comic has a son who does comedy too, off the top of my
Dana
head.
Dana Carvey?
I was thinking of Blake Clark and his son, Travis Clark, who's an LA-based comic.
Okay.
Who's pretty funny.
Oh, but wait.
It works.
Wait.
Yeah.
Travis.
Yeah.
His dad's a comic?
Yeah.
Who's his dad?
His dad's Blake Clark. He's the guy who plays the like the Southern talking guy in Waterboy and stuff like that. He's on like Adam Sandler movies, the older guy.
I didn't know that. I didn't even put that together that Travis had a famous relative. But Travis is very funny.
I didn't realize it for a long time either. And like Travis would start talking about his dad. And I was like, who's dad? Travis? And it took me a long time to think of like who's... Oh, idiot. Yeah, he even looks kind of like him. So.
I know John Larroquette's son is a podcast guy, which is... But that's not the same as stand-up. So.
But there's also Buddy Hackett's son.
Oh, really?
Sonny Hackett. And,
Paco's son, the gay porn star.
Yeah, I'm so proud of him. He Paco needs to Jr. shave, but he's a pretty hairy dude, apparently. I went and looked to see with this Paco gay. I spent quite a long time on his website.
Yeah. did any of you feel like you were supposed to follow in your father's footsteps?
Jeez, no.
Thank God I didn't. My dad sold insurance, so.
In Ohio.
Yeah, and I think my dad would love it if I'd followed in his footsteps.
Oh, sure.
Like he's always like whenever I would like talk about money problems, he'd go, well, you know, if you want to make money out there, I can put you to work. I'm like, no, I don't want to drive around LA trying to sell insurance.
No.
Like,
you get shot by the cops first. My dad was a fireman and a preacher. So I'm not doing either of those two things. Both of those things.
Isn't
suck.
Comedy being a preacher?
Kind of. A little bit.
And isn't comedy being a fireman?
It kind of is. There's a lot of ladders you have to climb.
A lot of Dalmatians.
You do drive all your shows with the siren on, right?
That's
what I do. I try to stop all traffic.
And it's what's also odd is I have a guy in the back with a steering wheel, which makes it really hard to get to my gigs.
And that guy's named Paco. Behind you with the steering wheel. So did your dad try to encourage you to do that?
No, my dad didn't encourage me to do anything.
All right.
except for kick me out of the house.
He gave you a name and he walked away.
Yeah, I didn't even do that.
I don't think that my dad expected me to do what he was doing. I remember maybe 12 years ago, I didn't really have anything specific going on other than like I was playing in bands and he was like, you thought about living in China maybe? And I'm like, what would I do in China? No one knows who Jonathan Richman is in China. I don't know. That's an example. It was just my world doesn't exist over there.
Is your dad from China originally?
He was working over there. So he was
he just wanted you to get away from him.
Well, yeah, he did want me. He was like, maybe you could come work for my company. I'm like, I don't do anything that your company needs.
Yeah. What
does he do? Well, he used to work at, he passed away, so in unexpectedly.
So don't so follow those
He hadn't retired.
For a while.
Yeah, but he was working for a battery company.
Mm.
So, he's lived here for a long time. I grew up here. Then when I was in college, he moved off to go work in China with some other guys. Starting something over there. So he was this is partly America's falling apart. You might want to come to China.
Right.
You look Chinese.
Century.
Maybe you can work on your Chinese. Maybe you can do some other stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, I'm just going to live in Oakland and make feedback on a,
do some, I'm going to be in a noise
band. Track. Basically that's what I decided to do. And I'm sure my dad was not happy about that.
But. Yeah. You're not Yoshikazu in that example.
No,
you're not going to follow in those footsteps.
My dad was pretty supportive, though, of me when he realized that I wasn't going to follow. I wasn't going to, when I was pursuing comedy. He's been very supportive. He does a funny thing, though, where he'll try to encourage me to get work in ways that he doesn't understand that, comedy's not like other jobs. Like, my dad one time asked me, he told me, he's like, well, have you ever called the hiring department at, NBC? I'm like, what do you think happens? Do you think there's a guy, we need to hire writers, but we just don't know where they're, no one's sending
their
resumes.
My favorite, though, is when you tell your parents that it's not how it happens. They're like, well, you haven't tried.
Yeah.
Have you?
My dad one time, he just sent me an email and he had Googled how to write for TV and just sent me the results.
Aww,
all the Google results.
So
he's like,
sweet.
Here's some advice
for
you.
You write a Hill Street Blues spec script.
Yeah, yeah.
What? This isn't applicable anymore?
You mail in your scripts. Yeah, my mom would be like, I love Jimmy Kimmel. You're like him. You should just talk to him. Yeah. I'm sure he's nice. I'm like, just
call him up.
Yeah. My mom left me a pretty funny message the other day. She's just like, well, I was watching the Emmys. I think it was the Emmys. And there's a young man named Andy from Berkeley, and he's hosting it. I thought you'd be interested in that. I'm like, oh, I looked up like Andy Samberg. yeah, young man from Berkeley.
Yeah,
yeah. Like, yeah, we have the same qualifications. We're young men from Berkeley.
You should talk to him. Maybe you'll get a job on that.
Actually,
Brooklyn
I
show.
Do have some connections to him remotely through like my friend who knows his wife. So, but
my
it's
mom,
no good.
My mom right now is, which is actually kind of relevant for this conversation for the documentary aspect. My mom's been watching I Am Kate on E! Mm-hmm. And it's like the first time she's understood a lot of my like transgender stuff. Mm-hmm. And so every time I talk to her, it's like getting a book report about something she read. And it's like, it's kind of adorable. And I love it because she's like learning a lot,
right.
And it's like better. Like
it's
she's learning more from watching
that
than she ever did from not listening to me, you know? So it's like and so funny because she'll still misgender Caitlin sometimes and then she'll catch herself as she's talking. So I'm not the corrector. Like,
right.
And like, she'll wait. It's like, and she'll ask me like random fun questions. Like we were just talking about something and I was mentioning a trip and she goes, so do you wear a girl's bathing suit or a boy's bathing suit? Like it was like out of nowhere. I guess in one of those episodes they were like staying at a
beach. That's a good question
house.
Though.
Well, I guess at a pool house.
I wear a 1910s.
You have to wear a sun hat. That's the number one thing.
Yeah. I'm a giant Doctor Who nerd and I bought a floppy Doctor Who sun hat that my friend recommended to me, but then I ended up taking it back because I realized after I bought it that it was like the cheapest. Like I spent like almost $40 on it, and then when I walked away and looked at it, it's like made of felt, and clearly they just made a Doctor Who like ribbon with the TARDIS logo on it and just put it over the hat. And when I realized that, I go, oh, I just spent $40 on this thing that probably cost $8.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I took it back. I was like, even I won't be taken in by something that dumb.
I'm trying to remember why Doctor Who did one of the doctors wear a hat?
Well, yeah, the fourth doctor wore a fedora sort of hat. And then the seventh doctor has like a bowler hat he wears sometimes. That's about the closest. And then the 11th doctor wears a fez sometimes.
It is getting nerdy up in
you
here.
Have a Doctor Who podcast, right?
I do have a Doctor Who podcast.
You and Brock have it?
Brock Wilbur and I have a Doctor Who podcast, which is fun.
What's
because
it called?
It's called Laughing at Archaeologists. And we watch the classic series.
Will gets it.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Well, we were going to call it Playing Doctor, and then somebody, like, literally in the time between when we thought of that name, and then, like, Brock even registered the Podbean page for it, and then, like, Brock went on the road with comic Brandy Posey for, like, a month, and by the time he got back from that trip and we started recording, somebody else had started a Doctor Who podcast called Playing Doctor.
Wow.
So then we called it Laughing at Archaeologists, and what we do is we go through the classic series, and we watch a different serial each week, and so, like, right now, we are in the middle of the third doctor.
So there's one episode you talk about an arc?
Yeah, because the way it used to work on the show, arcs would be split up over the course of like serialized episodes. Mm-hmm. So like one storyline might be like anywhere from like from as low as 2 to as many as like 7 or 8. We've even had as far as 12, which like at that one I even kind of watched on my own and explained it to Brock because he was not on board with watching 12 in a row.
So. Well, I noticed also you have an Iron Man shirt on. It's like, and I know Brock's deal is he's very about pop culture references. Do you find, and I don't know if that's so much of your act, is it super pop culture based? Do you think a lot of your act is?
I don't think it is as much as it used to be. Because I feel like I was doing that a lot when I first, like when I moved to LA, I remember I did a show and my friend was like, all your jokes are references. And I was like, oh yeah, that's kind of a thing. I think also my act, going back to the earlier conversation, my act really evolved a lot since I came out. Mm-hmm. And so now most of my act is very personal. Like it's a lot of personal stories about my life and my experiences. And it's my big focus is like, you know, my version of making the same thing over and over again is looking for personal things that seem very like alienated or different and finding ways to make them really like relatable to people who might not experience them. So like, I like talking about being transgender in ways that people who are not might understand it. I lost my brother 3 years ago, and I like to talk about this really sad thing of him dying and talking about it in a way. And I actually I'm very proud of the story that I tell about my brother's death. And it was like a thing where I was just telling friends about it and I was joking about it and they were laughing. And I was like, when they go, you should be doing this on stage. And I go, oh, it's too dark. And they go, you can do it. And then I did it almost exactly how I told them the story.
Yeah.
And it's been like one of my signature
things. Was he a Doctor Who fan?
No, no, he never would have been. It was funny. The last show that we used to like, you know, have like family TV nights or whatever.
Aww.
And the last show that my brother and I really bonded over was Sopranos.
Fucking Sopranos.
Yeah. And it was a show where I'm actually bummed because I met James Gandolfini once in LA.
No way.
Yeah.
No.
But it was before my brother died, and I really wish I'd met him afterwards, because obviously James himself has died now too.
Right.
And I really wish that when I had that opportunity, I could have told him how important that show was to me, because it's like the last real positive memory I have of my brother, because after that show ended, you know, he wasn't living at home anymore. We didn't have another show we watched, and then I moved away. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of fell out of touch with each other, and we only like would text on our birthdays and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, we love each other, but we weren't that close. Mm-hmm. He never knew I was trans. Mm-hmm. Or I think my dad told me, he told him, we never talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the last really like great cherished memory of my brother and I was watching The Sopranos. And yeah. The thing is, I watched The Sopranos and I thought it was like a really cool like novel for TV with all his characters. Rob liked to watch it because Tony was a badass.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
I feel like death is sort of like a weird overarching thing in this thing, because it's partly like this guy is in his 80s.
Yeah.
He's trying to like figure out his legacy.
Yeah.
It's a big legacy thing, and like the thing with the sons. And also, this is a part I can't speak to about specifically Japanese culture other than what they show us, but it's also about this loyalty mm-hmm. and leaving a legacy in this family name, like this yeah. Ono name, which there's a lot of Ono. So I don't know if it's specifically that, mm-hmm. but there's also that scene where he goes back to like where he grew up.
That was the best. I love that scene.
Yeah. Which it felt like a weird shift.
I think
in there,
I think part of that is there's some questions that I think they're the filmmaker is trying to get to, which is like, if you spend your entire life dedicated to one craft, is that enough? Did you miss out? Are there any unrealized, you know, dreams and, mm-hmm. you know, like choices that you can make? I mean, they show him like going back to like his childhood mm-hmm. friends. Right. And like, I don't know, you get the feeling they seem very happy and very like kind of, you know, chummy. And then I think then they show him on the train and it's like, this guy's been dedicated to this one thing this entire time. Like, mm-hmm. you know, what are the consequences of that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like how many weddings has he missed? Like how many, I think about that with comedy, like with traveling, like when you're dedicated to being on the road for a long time. Like I know so many comics who have missed out on so many aspects of like the important parts of people's lives that they're not like a lot of comics are so often on the road. They don't go to weddings. They miss out like on their own anniversaries and stuff like that.
Or having a family of their own.
Yeah.
Well, I think they make a point in that doc to show that little kid fishing and those kids playing in the tide pool, which is kind of like, you know, this guy didn't have that.
Yeah.
At 9, he was kicked out of his house and right. told that he never has a home to come to, and then he yeah. started making fucking sushi yeah. at 9.
That kind of reminds me of my dad, too. That's like a connection that I felt with the movie, because my dad, you know, there was issues with, he ultimately made peace with his father, but there were issues with his home, and my dad left home in his teens and like mm-hmm. basically like started working full time while in school mm-hmm. and like then he had his first kid, so like my dad was like, so my dad was an adult at a very young age, and it's mm-hmm. a thing where because of that, my dad is really lacking on a lot of pop culture knowledge. Like, I always joke about this, but about 5 or 6 years ago, my dad asked me who Bob Dylan was. And wow. I was just like, I didn't know what to say to that.
He's a boomer, though.
Yeah, yeah. He's a boomer. He's born 1950.
Yeah.
And yeah, so like, it's like he should be the exact age to know who right. Bob Dylan is. And it was when Bob Dylan put out the Chronicles book. And my dad's like, who's Bob Dylan? And I like, well, he's this very influential singer from the 60s. And my dad's like, oh, we called him Bobby Dylan. And I'm like, no, you didn't. You're thinking about, I think no, he's thinking of,
is that Grandpa Simpson?
I think he's thinking about Bobby Darin and getting mixed up. But funny thing is, or he's thinking about the character that Robin Wright plays in Forrest Gump when she's performing as Bobby Dylan on stage and she's naked with the guitar.
Oh, right.
Like, that's the only other thing he might have heard with Bobby Dylan on it.
Danny, put that guitar away.
Hey, sugar bro.
So yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I didn't really think about that. Like, he basically didn't have a childhood, this guy.
None.
Yeah, zero.
Yeah, and so they show him going back to his old childhood friends who seem to be, fun, and they're smiling, but they all basically say he was a bully.
Yeah.
You know, and that he, you know, even at one point he was like, oh, I used to yell at you from out the window to that old Japanese lady. And then they do this cut to this little kid fishing and the other kids playing in a tide pool. And I just took that as like, I think they're trying to bring up some questions. Like, what happens when you devote your entire life to one craft? What do you miss out on?
Mm-hmm.
And having that kind of success, is that enough in life?
Yeah. Again,
I'm reading this quote from Roger Ebert about the movie where he's kind of saying that same, that's actually a really good quote. It's kind of long. It might be too long to read on the air, but
go ahead and read it if you see it.
So let's see here. Let me do the Dan Carlin hardcore history thing. While watching it, I found my...
I love that podcast.
I do too. Yeah. But he has that weird thing he does with the voices when he does like any quote. He gives it so much more gravitas than the person writing it probably ever intended it to have. Yeah. Anyway, so this is Roger... Which is actually... This is actually weird because Roger Ebert himself was somebody who was so focused on film his entire life.
Mm-hmm.
But so... While watching it, I found myself drawn into the mystery of this man. Are there any unrealized wishes in his life, secret diversions, regrets? If you find an occupation you love and spend your entire life working on it, is that enough? Standing behind his counter, Jiro notices things. Some customers are left-handed, some right-handed. That helps determine where they are seated at his counter. As he serves a perfect piece of sushi, he observes it being eaten. He knows the history of that piece of seafood. He knows his staff has recently started massaging an octopus for 45 minutes and not half an hour, for example. Does he search a customer's eyes for a signal that has changed, that this change has been an improvement? Half an hour of massage was good enough to win 3 Michelin stars. You realize the tragedy of Jiro Ono's life is that there are not and will never be 4 stars.
Oh, that is a great quote.
Oh my God, that's deep.
There will never be 4 stars.
Wow, yeah. That's amazing. Yeah, and that's what he's such a perfectionist. I'm sure that he's striving for that fourth unattainable Michelin star.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
That's pretty incredible. Well,
I wish that I was a better cold reader than I was, because that was actually a pretty profound quote that I'm like, I don't know how sentences work.
I forgot how to read.
Oh, I hate cold reading so much. Yeah.
But that is absolutely true. And I guess that's pretty much what I was saying too, is like, what happens like when you do that? He devoted his entire childhood and adult life. And you know, they never brings up the mom. He obviously had kids.
Yeah.
Mom never, they
there
never
mentioned. There's no women really in this.
I mean, clearly
right?
He loves women, so I'm surprised that he hasn't.
I read an article that said that he will never... Oh, wait, we already talked about that.
About
women can't be chefs.
Yeah, yeah.
Or even he's going to serve them... He says at some point he's going to serve women smaller portions.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I think it's really interesting. I'm going to change it a little bit, but like, I think it's very interesting, the whole idea with the 20 to 30 minute 20 course meal. Because according to him, which is why he's saying this about women, it's like they have to eat... they need to eat faster, so he gives them smaller portions because in his mind, first of all, once you serve sushi, once you cut the meat, it needs to be served within 5 and eaten within 5 seconds. That's his thing. And he also was saying that if you take your time, you're going to get full and you won't experience the full 20-course meal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's odd because that's exactly how I eat. Pizza, sandwiches, whatever.
Yeah, I kind of the same way. Aside from sushi, I wish I was someone who savored food a little bit more. Yeah. I probably would eat less.
I eat more like a goose. I have a tendency to not chew.
Yeah.
You know, this 20-minute rule, there's some like sort of basis for that idea that like you've got this hormone that tells you you're hungry, and then you got this other hormone at the end of your intestines that gets activated, that tells you you're done. And like if you're someone like... any of us, I think, who just like eat whatever is put in front of you for 20 straight minutes.
Yeah.
And then we just don't have that shut off mechanism.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mine is an empty plate. That's when I'm like, oh, I guess I'm done now. Look at that. I feel like I want to get a little philosophical with you. Like, what did you take as a comic and someone who's making a parallel between, this doc, what are some of the feelings? Did you look at that and say, God, I don't want that?
I think it's one of those things where I'm very mixed on it, because I do like the idea of this like artist's life and this focus on creating this perfect art. But I also feel like maybe even more so with comedy than with Sushi, I do feel like you kind of need a certain level of life to be able to do comedy well, because if you're not experiencing things and you're not, that's one thing that I feel like that's a lot point. Of us early on, I think a lot of comics that even with natural talent and then like a skill for it, out of the gate, we might be really good start. Like I'm somebody who was a bit of a wunderkind when I first started doing comedy. Like my first year of comedy, I like skyrocketed up in the local scene. And I was surpassing people, like winning contests to get MC weeks. And then I become like a regular house MC. But I would say like 4 or 5 years into it, I really plateaued. And it took me a lot longer time to get out of that plateau than a lot of other comics who started around the same time as I did then surpassed me. Mm-hmm. And like a lot of people were getting feature weeks before I could and stuff like that. And part of it was because I just had not really found my voice. Mm. So I was good at writing jokes, but they were so like soulless and just empty and just observational.
Right. Arms distance.
Yeah. And so.
And you were like 20 or something when you started?
I started at 19.
19. So yeah, so your life experience was limited. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that my comedy is so vastly different now than it was back then, because I gave myself a chance to experience things. And the plus side of that is that because if you do that early point on where you've learned how to write jokes, then when you start experiencing things, you already know how to turn them into material, so you can do it fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think some people might have the opposite, where they've lived this whole life and then they have learned the right joke. So it's like there is a plus side to it. But I do wonder if like there is like you mentioned on the Roger Ebert thing about the idea of like, well, what is he missing out on? Like, is there something else that his life could be fulfilling for? Or is it really enough to just make the most perfect sushi in the world?
Yeah, I guess you only know on your deathbed when you look back, you know, in hindsight.
But I think food is such a specific thing that it is like, it's such a temporary, fleeting thing. Mm-hmm. So as opposed to like a painter or a musician, it's also that it is food.
Yeah.
And that there's like all this back research that goes into every little element of the food. But us as just pure dumb consumers, it's just like, burp. It's almost like, oh, what's the next Netflix thing I could look at that took someone like 3 years to make?
Yeah.
Well, and it tells you about his prestige in Japan that the Prime Minister of Japan would take President Obama there.
Mm-hmm. To a subway station.
To a subway station in a 10-seat sushi restaurant. They mentioned that he won some award. I didn't look up what that award was, but I imagine it's kind of like our Medal of Honor, or I don't know, I guess less military, more like Kennedy Center Arts Award or something. Mm-hmm. Lifetime Achievement and Doing Cool Shit Award.
Maybe it's also like, I think culturally food is treated with so much more esteem in that culture than it is in America.
Right.
And that's just because we are in this sort of fast
food.
Have
either of you guys ever been to Japan?
No.
Yeah. I haven't either. I've always wanted to go.
Yeah. Yeah. That is definitely on my list of things to do.
Yeah. I would love to go to Tokyo. I think Tokyo is just fascinating. I would love to. And I love like noodles and sushi and like that dude, the food critic guy. And he's talking about like, he's like, I went to every sushi restaurant, every soba restaurant, every, I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Dude.
Oh my God. Sounds
if
so
you
great.
Even see like some of their fiction movies, like what's that one? Tampopo. Yeah. It's all about like, you know, food culture there. I had one thought, and this guy's like basically born in 25. He lived through World War II also. That's not really super addressed, but I guess the fact that he was like kicked out of his house and he has these, when they go back to that village, maybe that's sort of just like, what is that like for people of that whole generation to have gone through that experience? And then, you know, he might just, that's got to scar you and traumatize you in all these ways. I feel like he's not emotionally available to his children. And but that's just the way that culture is, maybe. Yeah.
But he seems like like he was fun. There are so many times when they're just cracking up. And I do like how the last shot is him smiling on the subway. They kind of give him a little humanity there at the very end. But he and his son are like cracking up and talking about. And then, you know, he's hanging out with his rice expert friend. Mm-hmm. And they're joking and stuff.
I mean, no, he's not like a robot, you know. Yeah.
He has to at least be somewhat worthy of like, or like, so there's some level of him that makes his sons want to be around him, because like, you know, the point's often made that his son, what's his name? Yoshikazu, mm-hmm. how like he's not allowed to leave because of Japanese honor culture. But if you think about that, like, and you pan out, then where are all these apprentices coming from that are working? Like, they all have fathers too, and they're not working in their father's position. So clearly there is some leeway to go yeah. off on, and do your own thing, and he could do it. So clearly it is important enough to him to be in his father's life. And father. Yeah. Like, there is something about him that has a passion for it as well.
And Jiro's like a completely, he's a self-made man. He is like a definite, by definition,
like yeah. he was
a self-made man.
Really broke.
He had a, you know, terrible childhood upbringing and has this legacy that he wants to pass on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And will someone who's not one of his sons end up being an important Whoa. Person? And it's almost like the mafia or
yeah.
something.
Yeah.
Not to compare the Yakuza to this. But, you know, just in when our ideas of these family dynasties.
Yeah.
There's going to be this family dynasty just dedicated to perhaps fish. What's going to happen when fish go away?
Yeah. yeah.
Like, then For you real. Commit seppuku.
Yeah. Well, even talks about seaweed being getting hard to find.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah.
That's crazy.
It is also like, yeah, it's like the one other step. This is like 1% life in yeah. a certain way. It's not actually because it's affordable. It is affordable. Like $300 for this experience is actually reasonable,
yeah.
I think.
For someone on like a getting, vacation,
a world-class
yeah.
world class dining experience, but it's using the top of the food chain.
Yeah. However, yeah. I read an article that says that you will be kicked out if you're foreign. Like, they have a lot of bad service. I read this whole article about this place is not worth the money because if you don't speak Japanese, they kick you out.
Really?
Yeah. And if you manage to get a reservation and sit down and you don't really speak Japanese very well, they basically just rush your ass out of there.
Oh, man. That's,
you're not getting it. You're not appreciating it.
No sushi
yeah.
for you.
Yeah.
Obama's got this guy, the prime minister, yeah. is going to like talk
yeah,
to him.
Yeah, it's
going to
help.
So.
But, you know, I mean, the guy, I mean, that kind of stuff, I feel like, dude, you started working at 9, you're 90, you have a 10-seater sushi place in the subway system. Do what you do.
Yeah.
Do your thing, yeah. man.
Kick out however you want to kick out.
Yeah, exactly. So let's wrap this up. So what we do with our guests, we ask at the end if you would please recommend a documentary that you love, something that you've watched a lot and that you love, and or like maybe the documentary that got you into watching documentaries.
That's a good question. Actually, you know what? One that I'm really, I haven't seen the second one, and I'd like to see the follow-up to it, but there's a really interesting documentary called Sound and Fury, which I actually watched in college. I had seen documentaries before that, but it was one of the first ones where I really understood documentary as a narrative form. And it's about two brothers, one of whom is deaf and is married to a deaf woman and his children are deaf. And then the other brother has a deaf child, and the deaf child is going to be getting cochlear implants. And it's about the disruption in the lives of these people. And then what happens is like, the deaf brother, like his daughter thinks about getting one as well. And then like, I think like his wife ends up getting one or like that might be after the documentary, but it's really interesting about how deaf people, even though, you know, it's not necessarily an ethnic group, they still have a shared culture.
Yes.
And there's like a lot of that in there. And I feel maybe I relate to that again, you know, being transgender,
right.
I feel like, you know, there's a sense of community amongst like people of queer identities
sure.
who, you know, we didn't propagate into a culture, but we've like found each other. And a lot of, especially I've been very blessed, you know, I mentioned like my mom loves talking about Caitlyn Jenner. I've been very blessed that my parents came around and eventually like accepted me for who I am. But there's a lot of people who are children who are trans or queer or any sort of like gay, lesbian, who've been kicked out of their home and then they need to find a new family.
Right.
And, like, so that fascinates me about that. And also just the idea of like people who experience the world in a way that we couldn't possibly comprehend, but how different the world is for them, but also how much they find things that are similar to what we do. So that's really cool.
Yeah. I remember hearing about this, but I've never seen it. And that's from the year 2000. That reminds me.
There's a sequel, but
yeah. Have you seen, you're familiar with Moshe Kasher's book? Because he talks a lot about growing up.
Kasher and the Rye?
In a deaf community. He's he's got this really interesting.
Yeah, no, it's great. Kasher
I like Moshe. I just haven't read that book.
Yeah. His book's great, but Sound of Fury is a great documentary. I love that. And I was stunned to find that there was a division between those who have implants and those who do sign language.
Some of it's like very like angry.
Well, they show that picnic, right? Remember he goes to that picnic and they get into that big fight? That guy was like, that's not cool.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
that wasn't a deaf voice by any means.
I watched it in college. I took a class that was on disability in cinema, and it was all these different film depictions of being disabled, and that was the only one that wasn't like horribly like pitying and like pandering and like just like what's the word I'm looking for? Like patronizing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some of them were slightly watched.
Yeah. Most of them were narrative, though, right?
Yeah. That's the only one we watched that was a documentary. Okay, the other ones were all narrative films. Like we watched, my professor was blind. He's a poet named Steve Cosisto, who was like, am I saying that right name? I hope I didn't screw that up.
We can put in the notes.
But he's a poet and he's blind. He was a professor and he's teaching a film class, which is great. We watched like that. We watched like Out of Sight, which was At First Sight with Val Kilmer. Yeah. It was horrible.
Yeah.
And we watched Freak the Mighty, and we watched like Children of a Lesser God.
Did you watch Freaks?
Of a Woman?
No, we didn't watch Freaks.
Have you ever seen that? I just saw that. It's
I haven't seen it. We didn't watch
that.
We did watch The Elephant Man. That was part of the documentary. Mm-hmm. Like that was the only other one that was like maybe a little bit more like tasteful. Some of them were so just.
Yeah.
But yeah, Sound of Fury is really good. I recommend it. I think it's on Netflix now.
Oh, cool. Well, thanks, buddy. Thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
Okay. Yes, I also thank you.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thanks for listening. You can find episodes of SupDoc on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Please review, subscribe, and rate.
And you can follow us on Twitter at SupDocPodcast and online at SupDocPodcast.com.
This show is produced by Will Scovel, and our theme music is by David Siegel.
If you want to suggest a documentary or a future guest, please email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.